You know, since I was, I think about 19 years old, it's probably about 1989, more or less, I stopped reading newspapers or watching the news. You know, I realized, you know, I had actually came home from an evening out and about in which I had a various run-ins with the sublime and the divine and the transcendent, and I came home and there was the New York Times sitting on our dining room table in this house I lived in West Philadelphia, and you know, I noticed up in the corner was the tagline, the New York Times said, all the news that's fit to print. And I thought, you got to be fucking kidding me. You know, this is insane. I don't see anything in here. there's so much that I saw just tonight, you know, roaming the streets of Philadelphia, so since then, that kind of hubris and that kind of assumption, you know, so I have a lot of problems with the news, and I know there's lots of issues now around news, and I think they're all, in the words of Henri Bergson, they're all poorly framed questions. They're false questions. That's neither here nor there right now. That's not what I want to talk about. I don't want to talk about why I pay no attention to the news, why it upsets me when I see people who are internalizing things they've read in a newspaper so that their own lives are personally in turmoil, despite their everyday life being exactly the same. But no, I'm not going to go off on this polemic. I'm not going to get my bee in my bonnet. What I do want to say is I've noticed as of late, you know, my little interactions with the social media is that, I guess because of our, because of the present president, we live in times in which the political has become, you know, articulated, and, you know, it's not, you know, it's what happens. You know, we have a president who is a radical, right? The first radical that I know of, at least in, you know, more modern last century of American history. I don't really know much about FDR or anything, but, you know, this guy, our present president, seems a radical, you know, perhaps radically insane and radically anti-Semitic and radically racist, all these other things, but he's a radical. And that has unleashed all sorts of a whole plethora of, you know, political perspectives. You know, I see socialism as a word that's taken more seriously now. And, you know, I don't really know what the left wing means anymore. But, you know, especially after, you know, meeting the quite affable Thaddeus Russell and being on his unregistered podcast and engaging with him and a little bit with his audience, they're definitely more engaged and with social discourse, with public discourse about so-called political matters, something I've never dallied in at all. And it has me thinking a little bit about, you know, what really are my politics. What would be my politics? What is the relationship I imagine between people and a government and me? And I have a lot of ambivalence about the state in general. You know, there are things I want from the state. I want my roads taken care of. You know, I'd like some education. I would like people to be guaranteed a home. There are things I kind of want from a state, and at the same time, I find the state this overbearing, paternalistic beast, right? I can't believe the same state who keeps the roads think it's also their job to legislate, you know, drugs and sex, right? That's very strange to me. And so I was thinking, you know, what do I want from some kind of platform? You know, I mean, in general, I don't believe in platforms. I have that luxury, right? I'm not a politician. I don't have to have a platform. You know, that's the reason I am not a politician. You know, I prefer the individual revolutionary moment. And in fact, I think that the revolutionary is necessarily always particular, right? It's always a moment. It's always an event. And as such, can never be a platform. The platform, by definition, is conservative. And I'm interested in the revolutionary moment, the moment of the uncanny, the moment of surprise, the moment that belies structures, that undermines them, that births new possibilities. You know, I definitely have this will to the pluralistic and the multiple. But, you know, it had me thinking, how does this translate into legislation? You know, what would guide legislation and, you know, the political in general and the political discourse? And I began to wonder, you know, and think about Nietzsche. And I was giving this lecture, and will be a course soon on Renegade University. A course I'm giving on Nietzsche. And I recorded a lecture. And at the end of it, I try to articulate the beginnings of what I imagine a Nietzschean politics might be. And, you know, it had me thinking about Nietzsche's argument that in one's day-to-day life, in one's living, one should be in a situation in which they can say yes as much as possible. That saying no to things, I don't like this, you know, fighting this sort of inanity of the world is a drain, right? It's this sort of suck on vitality, a drain of vitality. It's exhausting. And when you imagine going through life and saying yes. And I want you to imagine this for a moment. Imagine from the moment you wake up in the morning to the moment you go to bed at night, that your life is a series of yeses. Yes. Oh, yes. So instead of an alarm clock going off and being like, oh, God, I can't believe I got to get up. Imagine whatever conditions in which you're waking up, it's, yeah, yes, good to wake up, yes. And the conditions of eating your food and paying your rent and your bills and the way in which income comes in and the way you think about the future and the present and the past all through the flow of your day are all a series of yeses. Imagine that for a moment. Right now, you know, I've engineered my life to have a lot of yeses, a lot of yeses. You know, I've never really had a job, place I've had to go. I've had to work. I don't come for money. Not money like that. Not money that says you don't have to work. You know, I'm a nice middle-class boy, PhD parents. When I had a job, you know, I've had two, you know, one for about a year, one for about 6 months, in which I had to go to the same place every day at the same time and spend the day there and then go home in the evening. I just couldn't believe it. I was just filled with no saying. I was like, I got to go here again? I got to deal with this again? There was so much no that I found it so taxing, just energetically, just in terms of survival. It was intolerable. It was unbearable. And, you know, I look out at the world of people who do that all the time, and I'm in awe, frankly, because I can't imagine their constitution. But the fact is, I also do sometimes see them on the way to or from these days where they have to go to the same place. And then, man, they don't look good. They look drained, right? It hasn't been a whole lot of yes saying in the course of their days. There's been a lot of no saying, you know? I mean, think about traffic and finding parking and the collapsing infrastructure of your train and then the idiot boss and the unnecessary meetings and the technology won't work. You can't get the audio to work. You get the video to work. The miscommunications. There's just so much no saying in the course of a day. And then on a larger scale, I think how much of my life just even avoiding these sort of, you know, so-called jobs, you know, I work for myself, but these jobs where I work for someone else, you know, the conditions of my rent, the conditions of leases, you know, and I'm about to get booted out of, you know, the third house for third place I've lived in 8 years. You know, the owner wants to move in. I got no rent control. They can jack up the rent. They can force me out all kinds of ways. You know, that my everyday is tempered by this overhanging shadow overarching shadow of imminent eviction, and perhaps inability to afford staying in this city to be near my son, who himself is stuck in a school system, in a public school system, but a school system in general, because the privates are not better per se, they're just expensive. But with utter inanity, just the complexity of what I have to explain to him, and you know, just to survive at his school and what to say yes and no to throughout the course of his day at public high school here in San Francisco. And you know, I think, you know, God, if I had to fathom a government and its legislation, you know, I would fathom it such that it facilitated the conditions of maximum yes saying. And this yes saying is not simply for ease or luxury, but so as to facilitate the extraordinary moments of life, the extraordinary moments, the inspired moments, what I want to call the ecstatic. And I realize maybe what I'm interested in is a platform of the ecstatic, a politics of the ecstatic. And what if we geared legislation? What if the very job of government, how it imagined it, for all of our sakes, whole public discourse was such that the job of the political, the job of our communal coming together in bodies of any sort, either, you know, more anarchic, more self-organizing, more local organized, or, you know, more federally organized, you know, on a sort of more general level, if they were dedicated to facilitating or at least maximizing the conditions of the ecstatic, what would that look like? Right now, the state is you know, and how we imagine the state is that we ask all these complicated and often contradictory and often egregious things of it. So, and hence all these ambivalences around it, right? So, on one hand, we have the state that sees its job as to somehow legislate the good, right? We still imagine the state as a keeper of the good. And that makes for all kinds of problems, you know, such as criminalizing drugs and criminalizing sex work. You know, it's like, what? Where did you get in your mind that's your job? Like, I don't want the state to be paternal. I don't want the state to, legislate the good. The good is complex and multifarious and individual, and I don't need it and want it to ever have to imagine itself as the good. So imagine no more debates around the good, right? And what counts as good. It's just like, that's just none of the government's business. Right, that's just simply not its task. Its task on my platform, you join my party, is that whatever we're doing, have we maximized the conditions of yes saying so as to facilitate as many moments of the ecstatic as possible? I think how beautiful that is, you know. So no more of the good, but also no more of maximizing or facilitating the profit motive, right? Of course, our government in this country has been, you know, since the get-go, since its founding, American Revolution was a bourgeois revolution. It was founded by, you know, business owners, property owners, and those who own the means of production, bourgeois in that technical sense. Just as the French Revolution was, right? These weren't revolutions of the people, right? They were revolutions of the bourgeoisie over and against nobility, right? And somehow they, you know, one of the fancy tricks of the bourgeois was to say we are the people, but we are the people only in regards to the nobility. But within the people, you have, you know, the bourgeois and the bourgeoisie and the proletariat and the lumpen proletariat, right? Those who don't control the means of production and those who are locked out of the entire cycle, the entire structure of production, you know, the lumpen proletariat are sort of excluded, the homeless and the insane and those who are just, you know, locked out for all kinds of reasons, due to their conditions or due to prejudices or due to all kinds of factors. But that, you know, so much of our legislation is about enabling the profit motive. So one thing I was thinking about recently was, you know, real estate and how weird it is, right? I have to move again in the next few months. You know, I've lived in my place a year. You know, landlord wants to move in. Okay, there's various instruments in place to help me out a little bit. I need to be bought out, but there's ways around that. But forget all that. I need to move. And the fact is, I might not be able to stay in the Bay Area. I might not be able to live near my son because rents are so extraordinarily high. And they're so high because property is owned by property owners, not by people who live in their dwellings, but by people who are profiting off places people live and work. And, you know, we kind of take for granted that's okay, right? That the land is something that can be bought up and monopolized, right? I mean, it is possible that one person owns every dwelling in the world, but certainly, you know, in the Bay Area. And the fact is, there are shockingly few, right? And all these new developments are in San Francisco, this sort of explosion of, you know, these live-work lofts. I feel ridiculous even saying that. You know, are owned by a concentration of big development companies, you know, and these people have they don't live in the area. They have no personal investment in the area other than money. And because of that, they have leverage and they can demand all kinds of monies from us. So that I'm not guaranteed that I can live near my son, you know, and something, I know we just take that for granted, but that's strange. I mean, who owns the land in the first place? I mean, how did it come to be that people with more money can own more land? And I'm not quite sure what a different kind of real estate market might look like, you know. But I imagine that, you know, there should be certain strictures in place such that, you're somehow guaranteed. I'm not sure what this looks like, but guaranteed a place to live and a place to live near your children, with your children and with your family, right? I mean, that just seems obvious, right? I mean, the fact that I would have to go through all kinds of things just to live near my son so he can go to some shitty fucking school. I don't know. It's maddening, right? You hear me about to go into a raise, all that negative energy. It's exhausting, right? I'd much rather my energy be put towards, you know, the joyous, the productive, the illuminating, the sublime, the transcendent, the exploratory, the erotic, the sensual, the friendly, the neighborly, as opposed to just trying to fucking be able to live near my son. It's just a big no that ripples all through my life. So, you know, again, I want to imagine a political platform that facilitates yes saying. And that means curbing a lot of the ways of the market, a lot of things that we take for granted. We already, you know, no one would say that roads should all be private, right? That you, for each street, you'd have to pay a company to go on those roads. No, we all sort of collectively agree that roads, for the most part, are public, you know, and we pay for them in various ways, tolls and various forms of taxes and such. But we just assume that, and yet we assume that the place you live in is not controlled, that is all privately held, and can be privately held. And, you know, to the benefit of the very few, to the benefit of the one. And that just seems like what an easy thing to begin legislating. You know, no doubt the economics are complex, especially, you know, how you'd facilitate investment in new homes, right? And new places to work and live, right? New dwellings. But, you know, a very simple measure, which is, you know, if you own something, you got to live in it. So you wouldn't say property is publicly owned, but you could put a limit on the housing market precisely because we're all here. We're all stuck on this fucking planet. We're all stuck in this place. One person doesn't get to buy it all up because they have more money. I mean, that's just insane, right? That just makes for conditions that do not facilitate yes-saying, that do not facilitate the ecstatic, that drain the ecstatic. And even for the guy who's seeking his profit, who's buying up all that property and selling it, that person is not achieving ecstasy. That person is not transcending, right? In this system, his most likely, or their, because it's corporate, their success is money, right? And that money buys them more access to the wheels of legislation that then, you know, let them steer more monies their way, right? So my point being that the governmental function, as far as I see it, in my, you know, relatively unlearned way, you know, just I never studied political science at length and different systems and different, you know, I understand that, you know, especially economic issues get quite complex, but that they're either imagine themselves as facilitating the good, right? Which is creepy to me. I don't need the government to be a father, you know, a parent, you know, I suppose, or a mother for that sake, but paternal sounds better because it is patriarchal, right? It's you know, patriarchy beyond gender, right? All the strictures of patriarchy. So on the one hand, you have this patriarchal paternal state legislating a moral state. Let's just call it a moral state. And on the other, you have the profit state, the corporate state. And both of those things create the conditions of a kind of relentless no-saying. No, 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 no. Get the fuck off my back. Let me be. Don't make me have to quash my life, my independence, so as to be able to pay some slumlord, you know, exorbitant rent, just so I can live near my son. Doesn't that seem sort of obvious, right? I mean, who would disagree with trying to build a political platform of the ecstatic? Doesn't that seem like why we're all here? Can't we just all agree that that's the thrust of it? And we all have our different ways to the ecstatic. We're not legislating how you or I or anyone should discover the ecstatic. We're trying to create conditions in which the ecstatic can emerge, right? In which there aren't so many hindrances, such as the 60, 70-hour work week just to pay rent, right? So the work week is another thing. You know, I picture, you know, watching movies and the like growing up and hearing about things like overtime and work weeks and the work bell and people leaving work. But somehow that's all gone away, you know, with the dissolution of unions. You know, work and life have, you know, become increasingly synonymous. It's the, you know, the rise of the interwebs and the always on, you know, telecommunication infrastructure, right? We're sort of always at work. And then especially post, you know, internet.com 2000, where work and life become synonymous. Like work should be your passion. Work, you know, working on your app is everything. Working for some company is everything. It defines you. You know, and that's of course okay if that's your thing, if that's your ecstasy. But to say that that is the only way, and in effect, that is the system in which we live. It's either implicitly or explicitly legislated, or directly or indirectly legislated and constructed, right? Such that work becomes the sort of dominant figure, right, the dominant institution that is supported through legislation. It's the things about which we argue, minimum wage and all this stuff. And it's like, you know what? Just let's limit, let's all agree. None of us. And this, so it takes out the competitive edge, right? Because it's not like, oh, I'm going to work 50 hours while you all work 40 and I'll get ahead. It's like, no, you know, it's a 40-hour work week. And if you all want to work more, that's cool. But you got to pay for it, right? You got to say, I'm going to choose to do that, you know? In that way, you know, you're not getting sucked dry every day, you know, being, you know, drained and humiliated at your job day in and day out just to make ends meet to pay your rent, right? You know, I think food is another thing. You know, there should be just basic food subsidies. You know, I remember for some reason believing, and I assume this was true or is true, that, you know, the French government subsidizes certain foods, things like wine and bread and cheese. And in this country, we do give subsidies, but it's for Big Ag, right? It's for corn syrup. And in fact, we could be subsidizing, you know, other kinds of foods to make the price of things like bread and eggs and meat or I can understand the argument for veganism on many levels, so maybe post-meat, but protein. But basic survival, right? So that, again, I have the conditions in which to achieve the ecstatic, in which to become ecstatic. And, you know, I don't know, again, this seems so obvious. Same with, you know, medical care. So a lot of the things I realize I'm coming to, sort of, you know, housing, food, work, begins to sound like a socialist agenda. And I suppose in many ways, I'm espousing kind of socialist agenda, you know, but I imagine it as a Nietzschean socialism as distinct from a moral socialism. That it's not about helping the weak survive. It's not about a safety net. Again, all this language. Within the discourse of government, I understand those things, and I would advocate for them. But I want to talk a whole paradigm shift in which we don't even need that vocabulary. We don't need the vocabulary of a safety net, because the conditions of our gathering together, of our agreement, of our public agreements, are such not so as to enforce the good, not so as to enforce profit, but so as to create the conditions of the ecstatic. Now, one of the great dupes of capitalism, one of the great jobs capitalism has done branding itself, is that somehow it has become the facilitator of pleasure. That, you know, I've had exchanges with people when I rail against capitalism. They're like, well, I don't want to give up my big easy chair, my Pepsi Cola, my cheeseburger. And I was very surprised by this exchange, because I realized that people imagine socialism as drab and devoid of pleasure, and capitalism is the purveyor of pleasure. And this is it's unbelievable to me that capitalism was able to do this. And the fact is, capitalism has co-opted the pleasure principle. You know, I'm thinking of Herbert Marcuse's book, Eros and Civilization, is that what it's called? You know, and that it gives us relentless pleasure in many ways, right? And the idea is, if I work, I get my money, I can get the pleasure, I can get that Tesla, I can get that enormous iPhone, I can get a bigger TV, I can get the nicer house, and that all of this. The idea of profit is that it is facilitating the ecstatic, but in fact it's facilitating a certain kind of pleasure, which I want to suggest is indifferent or perhaps even antithetical to the ecstatic. That pleasure comes from something, right? You take pleasure in something. It's always it's commodified. It is the yearning for a commodity, for something, even if it's an experience like a massage. But it's contingent on this exchange. And so, of course, capitalism loves. That's what capitalism is. It is this terms of this exchange. I will continue to work for you 70 hours a week so that you'll pay me my wages so I can just pay my rent. And then on the weekend, if I'm lucky, I can go out to a nice dinner. But I want to suggest that pleasure doesn't interest me. I'm not quite sure what to say here. Pleasure doesn't interest me that much. Of course I like pleasure. Everybody likes pleasure. But what interests me more, what is more radical in terms of a life, in terms of a relationship to life and to the public, is enjoyment. Enjoyment is slow. Enjoyment is thorough. Enjoyment is not the thing, is not what I get from something, but is my experience of living through something, right? I enjoy writing. I get pleasure from my gin. And sometimes I might even enjoy my gin, right? But enjoyment and pleasure are not the same thing, right? That what capitalism has done, by capitalism I just mean contemporary America, I don't want to get into an argument about what the fuck capitalism means. I'm talking about the conditions of contemporary America. Whatever this thing is such that, legislation and the public good is all facilitated so as to allow us the possibility of working so that we can make money and that money can buy us pleasure. And what I want to suggest in its stead, in my platform, is a public good which in which we work towards, rather than towards profit to buy pleasure, towards time to enjoy. It's about creating time, along with the conditions, a room of one's own, as it were, or even a room with someone else, but a fucking room, some food, some basic access to healthcare and books and the like, the time to enjoy, the time to revel, the time to indulge, to savor, to be permeated by experience. Things will rarely permeate us, right? And pleasure is premised on commodities, on things, even if those things, again, are services. But enjoyment is slow. Enjoyment is a living through. It pervades oneself. It pervades the body and the spirit and the mind and whatever else you want to imagine the self made up of. It's a thoroughgoing. Pleasure's never thorough. Right? Because it's always fleeting. It's always exhausting. It is quantitative. It is there and it's gone. It is consumed. But enjoyment is qualitative. And as such, it is slow. That's why I imagine the slow as a revolutionary act. And so much of public good and the government is about facilitating speed. And I would like to temper the speed. Right? The surveillance state is premised on speed, covering every square inch. Everywhere you go, it already has you covered. Right? It tries to stop time by blanketing the world in surveillance, right? And thereby eliminating speed altogether, because the surveillance state will always already be infinitely fast. And I want to suggest a slowness. So a slowness that belies and evades the corporate surveillance state, that evades the eye of the always-on camera. Right, that is allowed to linger in the gaps of the camera's relentless snap of the panoptic eye, and so in this platform of mine, the public good we're agreeing to is the creation of time rather than the creation of profit that leads to pleasure. I'm imagining the creation of time that leads to enjoyment. And then, from there, the ecstatic.